This is Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Just this week, another two Democratic candidates announced their intentions to run for president in 2020. Ohio Representative Tim Ryan and California Rep. Eric Swalwell. While Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado says he's all but certain to throw his hat in the ring. If you haven't heard of them, well, you're not alone. Why would these three candidates with almost no name recognition join a race already saturated with Washington insiders? Part of the reason is the current crop of frontrunners or wannabe frontrunners don't look invincible. The first quarter fundraising results for the candidates were decent, but not eye-popping. One of the early frontrunners, Senator Bernie Sanders, raised $18.2 million in the first quarter. It's impressive, but not much more than the $15 million he raised in his first full fundraising quarter of 2015. That was back when he was an obscure senator from Vermont and a long-shot candidate for the nomination. The other frontrunner is not formally in the race. That, of course, is former Vice President Joe Biden. Biden may be leading in the polls, but the last few weeks have provided a preview of the uncharted waters in which he'll be forced to swim. No one knows if he'll be able to stay afloat or if he'll be sucked down by the undertow. Meanwhile, on February 1st, the start of Black History Month, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker announced he was running for president.
I believe that we can build a country where no one is forgotten, no one is left behind.
Since then, he's been on the campaign trail and announced he raised $5 million in the first quarter. This weekend, he makes his official hometown kickoff of his Justice for All tour in Newark and then heads immediately to Iowa. And this week, I got a chance to sit down and talk with him. Now, for pretty much all of his career, Booker has been considered a rising star, and running for president a foregone conclusion. I wondered if he saw it the same way.
You know, I don't. And I've had a very unusual pathway, even to the United States Senate. I think the Wall Street Journal reported that there's only been 21 Americans in the history of our country that have ever gone from being directly from being a mayor to being a United States senator. My trajectory in life has been going to try to take on some of the toughest problems in our country, often in places that usually people were saying you should avoid. I moved into the central ward of Newark, New Jersey in my 20s as a law student and began organizing people, trying to bring people together to take down slumlords. And we saw a lot of success in those early years. And then we took on City Hall because we believed our city could do a lot better. And we took on some of the toughest problems in America, running a city that had been nationally known for crime and corruption and a decline, 60 years of losing population, losing tax base, and took over the city during its worst economic period in 60 years with the Great Recession, which for inner cities is a Great Depression. And what we were able to pull off, and I really emphasize we, because it wasn't me, we made uncommon coalitions that produced the uncommon results. We pulled together people to turn Newark's really trajectory around, to make it a city that's growing for the first time in 60 years, that's economic base is growing dramatically, as building our first new hotels in decades, the first new office towers in decades, supermarkets in food deserts for the first time in decades, and a school system that now, according to Washington University, is ranked the number one school system in America for low-income kids having high poverty, high success rates. But then even in Washington, at a time of the heightened cynicism, heightened worry about that you can't get things done, the biggest major bipartisan bill that got through Washington under this president was a bill that I helped lead for criminal justice reform on a very issue that my pollsters, when I was campaigning for Senate, told me not to campaign on because it wasn't one of the highest issues that was ranking for New Jersey voters. And I said very clearly, I'm going to talk about this issue all over the state because leaders don't follow consensus. They mold consensus. And in a nation that has one out of every three incarcerated women on the planet Earth, we are belying the truth of who we are, of being a nation of freedom and liberty and justice for all.
And yet, you know, the path that you took, especially as mayor, you worked with a lot of organizations, industries, whether it's the financial services industry or Silicon Valley, Mark Zuckerberg. Of course, you had relationship with folks working on the charter school movement, including Betsy DeVos. Those relationships are now, at least within a Democratic Party, considered toxic. So can you help us understand, you built these relationships, you built up, as you pointed out, the city of Newark using these communities, and now you're saying, well, I'm not supporting, you didn't support Betsy DeVos for education secretary, you're not taking corporate PAC money, you've sort of stepped away from taking money from industries that you once were taking political contributions from. Can you help us understand that?
Well, I don't think there's anything to understand, and some of that is unfortunately falling into the trap of folks who are exaggerating elements. Betsy DeVos was not a partner of mine in things in the city of Newark, and in fact, a lot of the things that she was doing in her career were things I was speaking out and fighting out against, and so that's unfortunate that you include that in that litany. But I will tell you this. When you are trying to get jobs in your city, when you're trying to build the first hotel in 40 years, or like we did with Teachers Village to build teacher housing in our city and new schools, which was a $130 million project, and you have a city that can't get capital, that nobody's investing in, you definitely create relationships with people that can invest institutional capital in your city for the first time. Because my neighbors on my block, I'm the only person running in this election that lives in a low-income community, black and brown community, we don't have time for purity tests. We need jobs in our community. We need economic opportunity. When you live in communities like mine, you deal with a sense of urgency. And sometimes the ideological debates or purity doesn't really fit with the needs of low-income communities who need jobs, educational opportunities, resources, alleviations from environmental toxins like lead in their water pipes. You need to get things done.
Before we move on, I just want to go back to one moment to the school system in Newark. And your relationship now, these years later, with teachers and the teachers' unions in the state and nationally, how has that relationship developed and where do you think it is today?
Well, understand that when I ran for Senate, I got the endorsement of our state's largest teachers union twice. The legislation I've worked on in the Senate, I'm really proud of, has been in coordination with teachers because teachers are savagely underpaid in America. And so the legislation I've pushed and led in the Senate to relieve the debt of our teachers who carry unconscionably high college debt, to have tax treatment for our teachers, which we live in this country that's outrageous, where you could work at a hedge fund and you pay less percentage of your income in taxes than a teacher does. I've been leading legislation to try to change that kind of tax treatment. So I've actually enjoyed, as a United States senator, tremendous support from teachers' unions and teachers who understand that my agenda continues to be about creating excellent public schools for all of our children. And then on the campaign trail, presidential campaign trail, I'm psyched to see lots of teachers coming out endorsing me because I'm out there fighting not only for teacher salary increases, teacher debt forgiveness, but also for our country to do what we say we're going to do. The Department of Education was founded for equity and inclusion, and we do not even pay our share of special needs education, which if I'm president, I'm going to change that to make sure that one of the most important streams of income coming from the federal government is fully paid so that schools have the resources not only to help special needs kids, but have the resources therefore freed up to help all children.
Not only are you a former mayor, but you are one of five current or former mayors now in this race, and you are one of six senators in the race. I'm wondering, you know, given how unpopular Washington is and how much attention the only current mayor in the race, Pete Buttigieg, is getting, in part because he's seen as somebody who's outside of Washington, he's a fresh voice, he's not part of this dysfunctional Washington swamp. I'm wondering, would you rather be running as Mayor Booker rather than Senator Booker?
Well, I would rather be running as Cory Booker, as a guy who, the only guy in this race who actually was a mayor, and actually I was more years than I've been a senator, that was able to show a case of taking on one of our most challenged cities and creating massive new opportunities in education, in healthcare, and economic development. And I've been a senator. this is a pretty unique resume in this field. Someone who knows Washington, knows how to get things done there, and who knows the urgencies that a chief executive faces to every single day get up and get things done for people.
Let's talk about you for a minute and your style, both of campaigning and just, it seems like, your personality in general, this very effusive guy. You can't read a profile about Cory Booker. This is quoting from a New York Magazine profile of you. They describe you as someone who talks about love and kindness and compassion and empathy all the time. America's a physical manifestation of a larger conspiracy of love. You like to talk about that. And I could see a lot of folks hearing this, and I talk to some of these folks now who say, that's nice and all, but man, Donald Trump is going to take that message, spit it out, and just destroy Cory Booker. And didn't Democrats already try this in 2016? Hillary Clinton ran on a message, we're stronger together. Michelle Obama told Democrats, when they go low, we go high, and that didn't really work out.
Love is one of the toughest, most durable forces ever. And when, you know, Bull Connor was being challenged and we beat him, and civil rights activists beat him, it wasn't by bringing bigger dogs and more powerful hoses. They shifted the moral imagination of a country through powerful nonviolent protests. And we make a real mistake right now. I ran a fire department. Fighting fire with fire is really not a good strategy for putting out fires. Donald Trump wants us to fight on his terms. And I think that's a recipe for losing the election and losing a mandate to lead all of America. I think this is an election where we need to see leaders who are going to call us to our higher angels, not talk about what they're against, but really stand for what we're for as a nation. Yes, we need a revival of civic grace. Yes, we need a more compassionate empathy. We are tearing each other apart as a country, and we need leaders that are not going to pit us against each other. We need leaders that are going to call us to a common purpose and a common cause again, because when I travel this country, I find so much common pain. So I think the best strategy to beat Donald Trump is not to do it, not to fight this election on his terms. I don't know if anybody emerged through tougher politics than I did and won, not by contorting myself to hate my opponents, but by calling to the larger community that we've got to come together, get rid of a politics of takedown politics that pits American against American.
Earlier this week, Senator Booker filed legislation to, quote, form a commission for the study of reparations proposals for African Americans.
Can I tell you why I'm frustrated and disappointed by this reparation conversation? It's because it's being reduced to just a box to check on a presidential list.
His bill is the Senate companion to H.R. 40, a bill which has been introduced and reintroduced in the House since 1989.
I never thought that a bill to study a really important issue like writing economic wrongs would cause controversy. The reality is we live in a nation where we have seen savage injustices. You know, in a city like Boston, the average wealth of a white family is about $280,000. The average wealth of a black family is about $8. And these things didn't happen by accident. We have seen, really, into your and my lifetime, overtly bigoted laws, redlining, mortgage policies, programs that were designed to lift our country out of, open up pathways in our country to the middle class, from the GI Bill to Social Security, being designed in ways to exclude or undermine African Americans' pathways into the middle class. And this doesn't just hurt black Americans, it hurts all Americans. You know, I live in a city in Newark where redlining and all of these other practices, or mass incarceration, for example, which has profoundly racial impact in our nation, where we have a nation that there's no difference between blacks or whites for using drugs or dealing drugs, but African Americans are between 3.5 and 4 times more likely to be arrested for those things. Those things actually create real economic harm, not just to African Americans, but to our country as a whole. We have a nation that, I think Villanova did a study that showed we'd have 20% less poverty in America if our incarceration rates were the same as our industrial peers. We have got to find a way to have our country truly be about equality and do things and policies that actually balance the economic scales. Now, I look forward to us studying this issue and having a national conversation, in fact, about our history, a lot of which we sometimes just try to cover over. Dark chapters that weren't that long ago that still have an impact now. But let me just say this. I'm not waiting I have a bill for baby bonds that says that every child born in this country should get a savings account and a deposit in that account. And this is something that can be paid for just by reversing elements of Donald Trump's tax cuts that gave wealth to the trillions of dollars of wealth to the wealthiest amongst us. That if every child got a deposit of $1,000 at birth, and then the contributions made into that account, upwards of $2,000 for the lowest income kids, depending on your family's income, by the time that the poorest kids in America are 18 years old, they'd have upwards of $50,000 to invest in things actually that create generational wealth, starting a business, buying a home, going to college. And one of the benefits of that bill, the way I designed it, is it not only will help every kid get a fair shot, an equity, a stake in our economy, but it virtually, as Columbia University says, eliminates the racial wealth gap. There are things we can do in our nation that address the persistent inequalities that were born out of overtly racist policies. And having a commission to study these issues, to find solutions to make us more fair and more equal, doesn't just address past injustices for African Americans. It actually helps our entire country be more successful.
And it's bringing the country along on this. I just was pointing out to you earlier this Pew poll, but let me read it to you. The U.S. has not gone far enough in giving blacks equal rights with whites. And 78% of black Americans say, I agree with that statement. And only 37% of white voters agree with that statement.
Look, I have to tell you, I'm the child of civil rights parents. People forget that when Martin Luther King died, 60% of America disapproved of him. I went to Newark, New Jersey in the inner city, not because it was the popular thing to do, but I joined with people who were fighting outrageous injustices in the community. This is not about polls. We have a country where people are hurting. Farm suicides are at rates that we haven't seen since the Depression. We treat mental health issues in this country with jail and prison. We have a nation where millions of children find it more easy to get unleaded gasoline than unleaded water, with over 3,000 jurisdictions where children have more than twice the lead levels of Flint, Michigan. Now, our media doesn't cover so many of these issues, but it doesn't mean that we don't need leaders that are standing up and talking about the injustices, even if it's uncomfortable to say those things, even if it makes you unpopular to say those things. And so I'm running for president, not just for the election at the end. I don't think you can campaign wrong and then think you can govern right. I have an opportunity now over the next year to try to affect the national conversation. And so I'm going to talk about things that may not be popular, like the bill to study the ideals of reparations, to talk about lead and water, talk about farmer suicides and why corporate consolidation is making the independent family farms disappear. There are too many people in this country who are losing faith. You want to talk about polls? Look at how many millennials now are losing faith in our democracy, losing faith in capitalism, because our systems are no longer working as they should. And so I'm going to not pay attention to polls. I'm going to spend the next year, hopefully 2 years of my life, talking to the hearts and as well as the heads of every American who was willing to listen, because I know we can do better. I know that we can create a beloved community. I know we can go from a sort of saccharine calls for it to be a tolerant society to the deep, nurturing ideals of creating a beloved society that is there for all of its children, that can have our country lead again, not on child poverty amongst industrial nations, not on infant mortality amongst industrial nations, not on the most expensive healthcare system, yet with the worst outcomes of any industrial nation, but that we can lead again to make this nation the most nurturing soil for not just dreams and goals for our children, but the ultimate practical success of all of our nation's families.
Senator Booker, thank you so much for coming in and talking to me.
I'm so grateful for this conversation. Thank you so much.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.